Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman, sharing stories of our food. And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman. Today, I'm welcomed by a good friend and confidant, Scott Soros. How you doing?
Doing great. Thanks, Aaron.
Scott, it is chilly out there.
It sure is. Not as bad as yesterday, though.
Not as bad as yesterday. It's New England in January. What do we expect? But it's crazy when you go outside and it's 20 degrees and you think, hey, it's not so bad out.
That's right.
Yeah. That's lifelong New Englanders. Scott, a little bit about your background, then we'll jump into today's conversation. Scott Soros is the former commissioner of Massachusetts Agriculture and served as the director of USDA Rural Development for Connecticut, Massachusetts, and Rhode Island for the Obama administration. Scott has 15 years of fishery and aquaculture experience prior to that, including early in his career, he served as the first Massachusetts coordinator of aquaculture for nearly a decade. Scott has long since been dedicated to improving the lives of fishermen and farmers through facilitating economic and environmental adaptation. The long and short of it, folks, is Scott is a trusted voice in seafood and terrestrial production up and down the East Coast. There you go.
Thank you.
I'm getting shorter every time we do this thing.
I'm happy about that, actually.
Yeah, yeah, I know. And sit there, and it's always funny to listen to read something right in front of you of your background, right? Yeah. So, there you go. Scott, let's picture this, what Orange County looks like right now, okay? Probably pretty nice. Today I saw that it's going to be 70 degrees, sunny, and perfect. That's kind of Orange County, isn't it? And I have a good word from a friend that just returned from the area over the weekend that they got some much-needed rain. That's all good and great weather for growing permacrops, well, really anything for that matter. And in fact, there are 400 different crop types that are coming out of California's 77,500 farms today. With cash receipts over $50 billion in 2017, our West Coast brethren now more than double agricultural sales in the nearest competing U.S. state, which is Texas. California is our cornucopia. It supplies the U.S. with two-thirds of fruits and nuts. It's our nation's sole producer, which means that it's 99% or more, as you probably know better than I, and major domestic supplier of almonds, figs, olives, peaches, dates, kiwis, artichokes, raisins, pomegranates, pistachios, plums, and walnuts, many of the things. I think we all have that namesake and appreciation that comes from California. Going layers deeper, here's some of the foodstuff gross total values. Milk and dairy from California, $6.5 billion. Grapes, $5.8 billion. Almonds, $5.6 billion. Lettuce, 2.4 billion, berries, 1.8 billion, tomatoes, 1 billion, flowers and foliage, over a billion, walnuts and pistachios, 1.6, and then 1 billion, respectively. Now, that is, that's the billion-dollar class right there. I mean, then there's numerous ones out of that. So food is a big part of California's bustling economy, with a GDP of $2.7 trillion as a collective, and that represents 40 million folks in California. California is now the fifth largest economy in the world. That surpassed the UK in 2017. So put that on your beans and toast and have it for Brexit. There you go. I had to work on that one. So, Scott, that's big time ag and big time differentiated ag in many of those food categories. In your time as commish of Massachusetts Agriculture under Governor Patrick and with USDA under President Obama, did you evaluate and try to replicate any of these success stories you've heard coming out of California and try to put that to work with an East Coast flavor?
Not successfully, in large part because of scale. You went through all the numbers, and Massachusetts, in fact, many states, as you identified, really couldn't compete production-wise. So it makes it especially different for us to look at the connections we might have directly to consumers versus the big ag operations that are familiar to California, that grow agricultural products and market them in ways that are different in many ways than what we do here in Massachusetts or in many of the East Coast states, for that matter.
Yeah, they're a bit of a market maker.
They are.
Well, today we can welcome a guest who knows a thing or two about California and about California agriculture. Today we welcome former Secretary of Agriculture of this diverse, this vast, and this beautiful state of California, A.G. Kawamura. Hey, A.G., how you doing today?
Hi, good morning. Good morning, Aaron and Scott.
Well, thank you for taking the time to join us. I know, I'm sure it's a busy morning, but we do appreciate it, and I know our listening audience will greatly appreciate your insight here. A.G., I'd like to just start by asking you, how are things going in California, and how are things going at Orange County Produce?
Well, it's been the start of a good year. We did get some great rains, and we're continuing to see rains stretching all the way to the north. I'm here in Southern California. Orange County is where Disneyland, just south of Los Angeles, lays in terms of the geography here. And we ended up with between 7 and 8 inches of rain over the course of a week. So that's a lot for us. We only average 14 or 15 inches of rain annually, so we're pleased. For the folks that grow strawberries, for example, that's one of the crops we're involved in. We like rain, but we like it when we don't have a lot of strawberries out on the plants. So we find that we get some damage there. And then just looking at the numbers you just mentioned about California being now the fifth largest economy in the world, I believe we still are holding strong as either the fifth or sixth, but certainly the right in there, the fifth or sixth largest agricultural economy in the world here in California. And so much of that, I think you mentioned the nice weather here today. It is currently headed up to maybe around 70. It's 65 right now. Beautiful blue sky. But that means we can grow crops all year round, and that clearly is one of the advantages that makes California maybe different than so many other states that have a hard, harsh winter. So we're doing well, and looking forward to an exciting year ahead of us.
That's great. Let me read a little bit more of your background, and I'm going to jump into pull on one of the threads a little more. So A.G. Kawamura is a third-generation fruit and vegetable grower and shipper from Orange County. He is the former Secretary of Agricultural of California Department of Food and Agriculture from 2003 to 2010. And as a progressive urban farmer, A.G. has a lifetime of experience working within a shrinking rural and urban boundaries of Southern California. Through his company, Orange County Produce, he is engaged in building an exciting, interactive 21st century 100-acre agricultural showcase at the Orange County Great Park in Irvine, California. So, A.G., you've seen California change a great deal in your lifetime. And in 2019, what keeps you up at night?
Well, it's you could ask me that same question almost every decade, and they seem to be the same things. We certainly are. Those of us throughout the state are alarmed about the over-regulation. We're alarmed about the lack on the federal side of an immigration policy that will work for the country and most importantly for agriculture, the skilled labor that we need to keep our operations up and running. That has continued to be an enormous threat, I think, to the viability of agriculture. Water is omnipresent. It's just having enough of it is critical. And certainly in Southern California, which is really a deficit state in terms of usually the water that we do get, we have sources that we depend on. It might be the Colorado River, might be Northern California, and then it's the regional water that we can use, whether it's water reuse, reclaimed waters, or our own aquifer, which can get impacted in any drought with saltwater intrusion. We have a lot of challenges there. There continues to be, and this would be for the whole country, and maybe with my secretary's cap on and Scott would know, invasive species are an enormous challenge for us. So they kind of suddenly show up and out of nowhere, you can find yourself in trouble with a disease. You can find yourself in trouble with a quarantine pet, and you can't ship your product out of your county or out of your state or out of the country. You can see a lot of challenges, whether it's the livestock industry with poultry currently or the citrus industry with a virus that gets into the trees and eventually kills the trees. These are the things that keep you up at night, the things that can shut you down overnight. And then the last one would be food safety, where you can have an outbreak like we experienced in California with the romaine lettuce. And that was just such a tragic pre-Thanksgiving nightmare for the industry out here. and continues to be one of our biggest challenges for all of us that have products that people eat every day. And keeping focused on food safety then is a whole new level of regulatory need and discipline that we all have to participate in, and it's costly. So we're still in this realm of, we can produce a lot of products. Can we produce them and make a living off of them? Is no different than if you're a large producer or a small producer.
AG, it's I'm with you on everything you identified. Although different in scale, the challenges that you mentioned are not dissimilar to what we experience here in, back during my tenure as commissioner here, or even now for the agricultural community. And one of the things you touched on is one of the challenges I know that we have continuously had, and I'm curious how you've worked to reconcile this, and that is the increasing costs associated with production and trying to reconcile how do you get that food that's produced by all of your farmers and by yourself for that matter, to the breadth of individuals who actually need that food, increasingly need that access that is always a challenge to get them that that food at a cost that makes sense for the farming community.
Yeah, and I think there's some really exciting developments in food systems, let me say, that we see everywhere, whether it's the Renaissance or the excitement around urban agriculture, for example, and the production systems that can be put into play, closed environment systems so that you can deal with off-season or counter-season production indoors, the new tools that you have to do that. I think we always make the standard joke that, you know, we can thank the marijuana growers of America for helping us really develop a lot of new tools while they were in the closet, if you will. And now suddenly they're fully available to create production systems that are very sophisticated, very technologically advanced, and allow you to really take a look at some production. And I make sure I always say that, I always used to say that you can't feed the world from a rooftop, and certainly you can't feed the world from indoors only, but it's an augmentation to the food supply that has become a very exciting part of, I think, what we're going to see in the future, because it's happening, and that's where this push of new farmers all over the country, including California, it comes from, I think, the urban, peri-urban areas that are starting to dial in new production systems that can be sold directly to either the consumer or different retailers that are looking for fresh, that are looking for novel, that are looking for, you know, supporting their regional food, their food systems, if you will, or the food shed, if you will, is really a leap forward compared to, say, 30, 20 years ago, 15 years ago even. We see that it's an exciting spot right now, and something that is catching a lot of attention globally.
Yeah, and I think related to that, I know one of the statistics that we continue to hear is the aging farmer population, of which you and I are, and Aaron for that matter, are all a part of that, getting a few more gray hairs nowadays. But do you see that the new advancements, these new opportunities with urban agriculture or peri-urban agriculture are driving that age down? We're seeing new entrants coming in from other generations.
I do see that, and there's some, you know, a whole new crop of graduates out of the different ag schools in the nation that are showing up with a whole new, a whole new toolbox, if you will, of skills. It doesn't mean that profitability is guaranteed in any way, and I think that's one of the challenges, is the viability of new ag systems and new production systems in this peri-urban, urban, or driven with a renewable energy sourcing. There's as many, I think, if you will, failures as there are successes. I don't know if it's 50-50, 60-40, but there's a lot of dollars pouring into this new area. But at the same time, viability comes down to the real simple thing. You have to be able to produce a product efficiently, consistently, with the quality that's expected, and not have a gaps, not miss your supply line, and then even then, what's the cost of it? And labor being tremendously expensive, especially unskilled labor, trying to deal with these production systems, there's a ramping up period where you start to dial in, you know, your expertise, and then you hope that you can also then receive the right amount of dollars to offset your costs. I know the experience of having been a very good celery producer once upon a time here in Orange County, and we had to quit because we were a high-cost producer. It's not that we couldn't produce great celery in our area, but our costs, including lease costs, water costs, labor was always a little high, but I'm only 100 miles away from the Mexican border from Baja California, and there comes a point where if you're a high-cost producer and can't get that extra value-added dollar to offset your costs, you're going backwards pretty quickly, and these are the challenges, I think, as many regions around the country are facing as we see it's a North American competitive market, not necessarily just the U.S.
E.G., you had mentioned water being one of the new costs that are affecting the overall output and capacity to actually turn a profit here. You also had mentioned one of the things that keeps you up at night is the issues with water. And water is increasingly becoming a concern everywhere, but especially in California. And that's from the overuse to the irrigation of misplaced crops to the loss of hardpack in the Sierras to poor soil health, not being able to store the water in the living soil, or overtapping the deep water aquifers, or even arcane water use and ownership laws. Just to name a few with some of the issues we're having with water. So, as mentioned in the preamble, California is essential to our country. What should we do with the water concerns there, and what should be done to set it up for the next 10 years? Do you have solutions of change that we can look to?
Yeah, I do. There's a lot of, only because we have this history of, tremendous history of fighting about water, developing water, envisioning systems that can create water availability, all the above, and nothing's changed except for, as we see our growing population here in the state of California, we seem to recognize let me backtrack on that. We maybe fail to recognize collectively as a state that if we invest in the infrastructure for abundant water, and that still includes efficient water use and not abuse of it, but if we can invest in infrastructure in its many different forms, it sets us up for the future, the rest of this century, as a state that can have abundance of water if it does it wisely. There's many people that will argue we have plenty of water, but we're not necessarily managing it correctly, and we haven't created infrastructure improvements for 50, 40, 60 years, depending on what part of the state you're looking at. And yet, at the same time, there's been just tremendous advances in ability to, for example, work with reclaimed water and re-inject good water into the aquifers to replenish aquifers. Some of the most studied watersheds in the world and engineered watersheds in the world are here in California, and I think people just don't quite recognize how much progress has been made. But what we do here is, if we can't get the citizens of the state to vote for or to support an infrastructure that actually has impact at the federal level, in other words, this is kind of the strategic critical infrastructure that allows for food security for our nation, if we believe that domestic food production is important to the nation, then you would think the feds as well would be here investing along with the state of California, along with its own citizens, along with everybody that eats, would be investing in this, in a robust infrastructure to secure and, you know, give us, if you will, the best predictability of an abundant water supply that we can. It still comes down to the very stark reality that if we get into a 10-year drought like Australia did, we're in deep trouble. And it makes all the more reason why we would want to invest now to try and get ready for those kind of predictable hardships that will come.
Yeah, I think it's too logical what you're talking about, AG, of actually people worrying about feeding ourselves, those small things like that, right? It's intriguing because, and I use that just to set up the conversation, because so many of those things tie into our overall national conversation we're having around climate change, of how can we do this? How can we not have the appreciation that our impact is real and drastic, and it's going to have immediate and lasting impact? And as to your point of Australia, boy, it's not climate change there. It's climate adaptation at this point. And so appreciating the magnitude of your impact and the leadership in California has seemed to adopt and pick up many of the acts and initiatives and research to remediate climate change that our federal government has let sit idle. With climate change seeming to impact you and your citizens first, was this a strategic decision or more of a pragmatic decision to lead us stateside?
Well, I can say that this challenge that we have and the disconnect, I think, between the public sector and between many with the food production side of our human endeavor. You know, we say this, you have in California, you know, in the United States, you have approaching 400 million people. California, it's now about 40 million people. Globally, we're at 7.8 billion people. Everybody can't quite grasp, I think, that I have a friend who's 94 years old and he's an active farmer that might retire this year at 94. He was born in 1925, and in 1927, the global census estimate of population on the planet was 2 billion people. So in the course of one man's life, we've added, 5.8 billion people, just about, in the course of one man's life. And this discussion about how do we produce enough food for the 7-8 billion, how do we produce enough food for our country, if it's disconnected with the ag systems that have to be in place, again, it's the capacity of produce enough food that's kind of the critical thing. We might not have the will to give food to everybody, which is clearly the circumstance around the world today. We just don't choose to feed everybody. We could, and hopefully we will, with those sustainable development goals that are out there. But what we need to know right now is, do we have the capacity to feed everybody? And in that capacity, you have to invest in infrastructure. You have to have the base of bare essentials, if you will, whether it's land, whether it's water, whether it's the right climate. And whether it's climate change or changing climates, let people argue about that. But if we do see that there's a shift in climate patterns, we better prepare ourselves with a better, more robust toolbox, again, of how the producers of the food that you depend on, how are they going to more predictably be able to say that they can get it done, get this job done of producing calories every day for a planet. So what happens, though, when we have so much abundance and everybody can go to the store today and get all kinds of off-season products, produce, and great food choices, in abundance comes this, the luxury of abundance comes this kind of indulgence in, our food system's broken, let's start tearing it apart, or let's start arguing about why do we produce XYZ, we should stop doing that. And I always will say that that's such a wonderful indulgence to have, that people can be so critical of our food supply today because their mouths are full. And the minute we hit scarcity, it's a different, we have a different story.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, AG, one of the biggest challenges, and I think you're touching on this, is how do you educate those consumers? How do you best get them to recognize that, so we can avoid what ultimately becomes crisis management rather than proactive planning that gives them the choices they want, but with measure, so that they understand where it's coming from and what goes into it. And I think, the urban agricultural developments, and whether it's, again, it's the peri-urban or the actual urban on the rooftops of buildings like here, even in Boston, the Fenway Park as an example that has a garden on its rooftop in the middle of Boston. I mean, there are real educational benefits that I see to that ultimately do provide the education that consumers so desperately need, so that they recognize, where the food comes from, even if they're not the folks that are responsible for producing it.
Yeah, exactly. I got to see some rooftop gardens in Chicago that were just wonderful. And who knew that a little 3 inches of topsoil can produce so much? We all know that kind of inherently, but on a rooftop garden, it was fun to see the diversity of plant life that someone could produce in a spot that was previously never utilized for food. And so I think our imagination of what our food system might be gets to be the maybe the in this century is certainly we already are seeing things that we thought were not feasible or actually impossible, you know, 50 years ago, 40 years ago. We're moving past feasibility and into reality. And as we see that, we just have to be careful that it's a measured appreciation that we need all these systems running well, because invariably one system or another is going to have a fart, if you will, is going to have a failure. And thank God, if there's enough abundance from the other regions, from the other systems, we get to keep on moving forward, as opposed to what happens like with the Arab Spring, or back to a depression, or back to some of these other long list of historic food collapses, if you will, food system collapses for civilizations. We just have to kind of remind the public that it's not a given that you get to eat every day. We certainly enjoyed it for our lifetimes, but my biggest concern continues to be, how vulnerable is the global food system? Well, it's very vulnerable, really.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's a national security concern. It really is, when people truly understand what the impact is and the resources, the requirement, and then obviously the output of that. AG, you had touched on immigration, which I think for many don't realize hides behind the cloak of cheap food systems. And what we don't appreciate, I think, is that it's estimated that 60-80% of on-farm labor force is undocumented. So you're in the hotbed of it there in California, especially in Southern California. What insight can you provide our listeners? How can we do this better? I mean, do people not realize that if we don't have this labor force, we don't have access to this plethora of food?
Yeah, I think the number one point we all might observe, and for anybody that's an avid gardener, in other words, they have a skill set of what it's like to take care and cultivate plants. The skill set that you need to, whether it's prune an orchard or a vineyard, to harvest delicate fruits, to harvest a field with a hoe, everybody, you know, it's not. We understand that if you are just digging a ditch with a shovel, the skill set may be quite a bit different there than the multiple other tasks that have to take place on a farm, or dealing with, whether you're dealing with animals or not, the recognition of plant health or animal health. That skill set is so critical and yet so underappreciated. And in our immigration system, which is broken, we've never quite come to a full appreciation of just how valuable our farm people are, if you will, are the people that actually work with their hands, their eyes, and their minds to get the crop to a table. And that goes back into a kitchen as well. This group of folks that is probably the most unappreciated, and maybe I'm just stretching a bit because I'm in agriculture, because we're farmers, is one of the saddest commentaries of how the public perceives the endeavor, as if it's something that they just don't want to get their hands dirty, literally, right? And so how great that would be to have a kind of a new push for thinking about these critical jobs. It's funny, we're having a strike with teachers out here today in LA County, and there's many societies over the course of history that valued the folks that produced the food and valued the teachers and put them at the highest levels of appreciation within any society, and we've kind of moved away from that for many different odd reasons. But I like to always say that if you can just appreciate those people that are productively doing things every day and actually producing something of value for the citizens of a nation, how nice that would be if we could move back in that direction of respect, of compensation, and more importantly, of protection. Because you lose those skill sets, and what do? You find yourself with a civilization that's on the verge of collapse, right?
AJ, I'm going to read one more part of your background just so our listening audience has an understanding of the breadth of what you're putting out there and the shadow that you've cast. AG Karamora is co-chair of Solutions from the Land, a nonprofit organization that collaborates with farmers, ranchers, foresters, and stakeholders to implement climate-smart land management practices and strategies. Additionally, he currently serves on several boards and committees, including the Ag Advisory Committee for the Agri Initiative, the Board for Agriculture and Natural Resources, BANR, a policy arm of National Academy of Sciences, Natural Resource Council, the Ag Advisory Committee for Chicago's Council of Global Affairs, American Farmland Trust, the 25 by 25 Alliance, and some work with the ASI group at UC Davis. So you're very active locally, you're active nationally and internationally recognized on these levels. So with all your exposure and wisdom that you've gained through your career, what gives you hope now? What is it? Is it the people that are doing something of value and additional appreciation? Is it an anecdote that you've seen? What could you share with our listening audience that gives you hope?
Thanks. I would want to correct that. I am no longer on a couple of those boards, including the Board of Ag and Natural Resources, and stepped down from the ASI board as well, external board. But what I see daily in my own fields, in our own operations, is this sense that we're not going backwards, we're moving forward in our capacity to understand, you know, if you will, agriculture is kind of simply described as we're managing life systems and utilizing resources, hopefully sustainably in what we do. And that's what defines agriculture. There's a lot of different kinds of life systems, whether it's the plants themselves or the animals, whether it's the soil, microbial populations that are underneath that are driving so much of new science right now and new understanding, even though it's been around obviously forever. The fact that we have to move forward, and we're watching just remarkable progress in different regions, different areas, with different production systems or production concepts, gives me great hope. I keep on saying that if the goal is to create abundance so that people have choices, and I do believe that's the best pathway for us as a world, it's okay to have abundance. It's okay to have a lot of choices. And so that way, the people that have choices and want to say, I'm going to only eat this way, I'm only not going to eat this or that item, but get away from this, my choice is better than your choice. I think we have to kind of get there. I see that the rising, and I hope most of your audience, I ask this question a lot, if you've had a chance to look at the Sustainable Development Goals, those 17 goals to be accomplished by the year 2030, if you take a good hard look at those, you realize that you cannot, and I underline that word, cannot accomplish those goals if agriculture is doing poorly on the planet. It's very easy to see that, you know, maybe 7, 8, 9 of the different goals have a lot to do with agriculture. And that might be including, for example, women in agriculture in different continents where they represent a huge percentage of the current farmer base that exists. To be doing well in agriculture means that we are thriving and we're creating abundance so we can thrive. In the absence of abundance, you have scarcity, and that's the minute that you start to see that we'd be moving backwards. And I continue to feel and believe that we have so much excitement ahead of us, and maybe because I farm in California and I see so many different regions where we produce food, whether it's in a desert, in a mountain, on a city, under extreme rain or extreme heat, where all those geological regions exist here in California, and I get to see progress in all of them. And then on top of that, this new push and this new renaissance of knowledge that we get to share across the planet through the internet, as the new extension, if you will, for the 21st century, I get to learn all the time just by going online instead of going down to the old field station and, you know, looking up the microfiche, folders and pamphlets to teach a person how to farm. So I know I'm just rambling on, but I think what I'd like to see is to say is that there's a renaissance taking place. We're in the middle of it. If you're not aware of that, just look at this fella I mentioned earlier in this podcast that's still farming at 94 years old. He was actually had a team of horses that he remembers the names of the horses when he started out. To think that we aren't in this enormous leap forward, you'd be mistaken. And then more importantly, to think that we don't have to be fighting about our global food system, but helping each other make it better and more resilient. That's what drives many of us. This, and Scott, you're there too. It drives us to know that, you know, whether it's through our ag ministries, our ag departments, it's a handhold with government to give us the infrastructure so the farmers can actually do their job. And instead of being attacked, that my biggest request is let's get back to focusing on the progress and the assistance that we need to get the job done.
And Scott, how about you? 3,000 miles away, what gives you hope?
Yeah, I think it's safe to say that, AG, I'm an eternal optimist and very optimistic about what is happening now and what is to be with food production generally. I subscribe to a quote that, it's on a coffee mug that I have at home from Wendell Berry, that eating is an agricultural act. And I think more today than ever, including the 10 years ago when I was sitting in the commissioner's seat here in Massachusetts, that you have more and more folks who not only know more about agriculture and where their food comes from, but they want to know more about where their food comes from. So they're actively being engaged, whether it's in their own projects themselves, whether they're a member of a community-supported agricultural operation or a program, or going to the local farmers markets that are all growing across the country, or engaged in their own community agricultural activities themselves. I see more and more of that, and I know it's not just because I'm close to it from the kind of work that I do, or I know that AG does out in California. So I'm very optimistic. And I think the things that AG mentioned around technology, adaptations of technology, utilization of technology, you're not limited to what's happening in the field, but things like we're doing right now. Podcasts were not a thing, at least that I was aware of, back 10 years ago, but things like this this show and airing this and getting the word out about other resources that are out there and folks that are working in the space adds to that optimism, and I think also fuels the continued development of folks to really know where their food's coming from and how it's produced, and I think also importantly who's producing it and how they're producing it. I think one of the great privileges of working as a chief agricultural officer in any of the states is the opportunity to get to know the folks who are at the heart of bringing that food to market. And in many cases, it's so much more than just a job. In fact, I would say in every one of the cases that I ever ran into, it's a way of life. And it's oftentimes multiple generations that are engaged in their family businesses that happen to be around food production. And because they're working with dynamic systems, they are changing yearly, if not weekly throughout the season, based on weather patterns and environment, not to mention things that happen beyond their control when it comes to state or federal regulation. So I like AG, am very optimistic, and I see great opportunities coming ahead for not only those who are in the food production sector, however that might be, but for those who are benefiting, which is all of us, from that food production sector.
Fantastic. AG, where can our listening audience learn more about your work and about Orange County Produce?
Well, again, our Orange County Produce is our farm company, for-profit company, that's now, how old are we, 70 years old, over 60 years here in Orange County itself as a family business. But our nonprofit efforts, and you mentioned, thank you, Solutions for Urban Agriculture, SFLDialogue.org, Solutions for Urban Agriculture is another nonprofit. That's SFUA.org. Solutions for Urban Agriculture is our local nonprofit that has been basically providing food for the food banks through agricultural models for the last 30 years, and we're really ramping up and getting a lot of excitement done in this urban area. I always say to people, say, oh, you're an urban farmer. And the truth is we're farmers that were here in a rural area and all the urbanization came and surrounded us, and we're still farming in much the same way we would have been doing it 40 years ago, but we're surrounded by, you know, freeways and houses and apartments and buildings, and we still farm in between those buildings and underneath the power lines. So our reach into new vertical and horizontal and repurposing public lands for food production, whether it's going to go into a local chain store or a regional chain store or directly into a food bank, these are all the things that we talk about on our Solutions for Urban Ag group. And then Solutions from the Land, I'm sorry, this is a little confusing, but Solutions from the Land, SFL, which is our national organization, we've been working on large landscape projects, whether it's the Delmarva Peninsula, that's the Delaware, Maryland, Virginia Peninsula, helping the poultry industry and the other farmers in that area, you know, maintain a food basket for the Eastern Seaboard, whether it's in the Ohio River Valley, where there's a wonderful project right now called Ohio Smart Agriculture, and that's a project that's up and running. We're working collaboratively in Florida, in North Carolina, and other areas. And those projects are to look at agriculture on a much larger scale, not city by city, but region by region, watershed by watershed, and look how that you would collaborate with all your partners, which is basically everybody from the environment, from food justice, from social justice, from landowners, farmers, of course, the operators, the land stewards. And we've always felt that if we can work with the stewards from the bottom up instead of from the top down, it's the producers that actually have to work the land and work with the different life systems. They're the ones that can help come up with the solution sets working collaboratively to make things work. So please do visit those websites. And we're, as always, because we're nonprofits, we would welcome any and all funding assistance, but we're busy. Let me put it this way, the easy way. It's been a while since a group of us said, no more think tank. We've done enough think tank work over the years. Let's do a do tank. And so we're busy doing things instead of just talking about them or just discussing them. Yeah. And that's been fun. That's very rewarding. And it's more importantly, it's starting to bring great results. So please do visit those sites.
That's fantastic, AG. I will include links on the write-up, both on the website and also on the iTunes account. You know, I'll just close by saying, as AG had mentioned, agriculture is managing life systems. I think that's quite a clean and genius way of stating it. And as AG also was talking about, is agriculture is the linchpin for the many of the 17 UN's SDGs. And those sustainable development goals are defining a common language that we can all speak globally around dealing with the fact that we've got 7.6 billion people, that we have to manage our natural resources in a better way to feed ourselves, and that will ultimately determine planetary stability. We are in the midst of a renaissance, and it's taking place in agriculture and food and with the consumer. And I've had one advisor describe it to me as an ecological enlightenment, which I thought was quite a beautiful way of stating that across the gamut, up and down the vertical stack, we have people that are becoming more aware of the impact of food as a silver bullet. So we can only hope so. And if we have hope, and there is hope here, and there's great potential, and if we've got folks like A.G. Caro-Mora and Scott Soros that are doing and solving these problems, well, I have hope, and that's an exciting thing. So, Scott, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to partake in today's conversation.
My pleasure. I wouldn't miss it. AG was a mentor a decade ago when I first came into the commissioner's seat here in Massachusetts, and happy to see that he's still fully engaged in what he's doing and what was doing then, and even more so now. So great to be a part of the conversation, and so great to hear your voice again, AG.
Thanks, Scott, and likewise, it's just exciting to know that We're all in this together moving forward. So thanks for your great efforts and leadership as well.
Oh, my pleasure. And I think we still have the same barber, if that makes any sense.
Well, AG, thank you so much for taking the time. We greatly appreciate it. I learned a great deal. I know our listening audience will as well. So thanks again.
Aaron, thank you so much for the opportunity to share with you, and more importantly, for all the good work you're doing. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Enjoy the nice weather.